Hey everyone, welcome to the New Insight podcast, where we interview the most important movers and shakers in ophthalmology and give you new insights on the innovations ahead. I'm your host, Viral Shuth. My guest today is Brad Dorschuk, the CEO of InFocus Clinical Research, one of the leading clinical research organizations in our space. In our conversation, we discuss Brad's background, including how in 2015 he co-founded InFocus with a large group of retina stakeholders to address what they saw as a critical unmet need, a clinical development partner with retina-specific expertise to meet the needs of the then-emerging tsunami of retinal studies and development. In addition, we discuss the current state of retinal clinical trials and some of the challenges we have as investigators and sponsors in terms of recruitment challenges, staffing, and all of this in the middle of an ever-changing therapeutic landscape. We get into what Brad is most excited about as someone that is at the nexus of clinical trials and someone that gets to work closely with both sponsors and study sites. I'm thrilled to be able to give our listeners some new insights from a true leader in our field. So without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Brad Dorschuk. All right, Brad, hey, thank you for joining us on the Insight podcast. I'm happy to have you here. You know, people that are listening, we've had lots of different people on the podcast before, you know, people that are running the sponsors, we've had investigators, but we have yet to have someone representing kind of where you represent, which is that kind of intermediary, the people that kind of help us get trials done as a CRO. So for people that are, you know, joining us and are maybe new to that concept of the CRO, can you kind of explain, well, first of all, you know, thank you for joining us, but second of all, kind of where you are in the space, what you guys do, and then we'll get a little bit into kind of how you ended up in this space.
Absolutely. Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity and love to share some background on CROs, what we do, and especially in the retina space in particular. So addressing a CRO in general, it stands for Contract Research Organization. The moniker has taken many forms over the last 40 years. A lot of companies hijacked it, if you will, from laboratories to preclinical groups, functional service providers. The traditional definition is it stands for a company like ours that is a full service provider managing clinical trials, running the studies. That's clinical project management, clinical site monitoring, medical monitoring, drug safety and pharmacovigilance, biostatistics, data management, statistical programming, quality, and regulatory affairs. So that's kind of the whole nine yards of a CRO. The industry itself formed, maybe in the 80s, 70s and 80s, when big pharma companies realized that they were staffing up these big groups to, you know, develop these big blockbuster drugs. And then when the drug's approved, those teams don't have anything else to do until another drug matures through the preclinical process and such. And so it was just a big ebb and flow roller coaster ride. So they started outsourcing that process. And a vast majority of all of the human clinical trials, phase 1 to 4, are executed, managed by CROs around the world.
Oh, that's excellent. So you know, you guys are huge in the retina space. And so I want to kind of go through the evolution. You know, you and I have talked about it in the past. This retina in general is really a hot space in terms of research and development. You know, we can go back to when Lucentis was developed by Genentech to now, and just the boom of research that's happened, you know, looking at macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and the likes. So tell us a little bit about, you know, maybe when that started, kind of where you were at, and how you know, 20 years later now, since really Lucentis came to market, how you developed InFocus and kind of what was the genesis of it?
That's a great question. The and to your point, the retina space in general is still almost hidden to most people in medicine. But the reality is, I argue that it's probably one of the top three areas of medical research and advancement, investment, and really excitement right now. The first one maybe is oncology, has been for 20 years, will be for another 20, and if we can hopefully really tackle cancers. And then Alzheimer's and related disorders, there's not much treatment there. And then retina is number three. And as you noted, the first treatment, so I think macugen might have been the first treatment around 2006 or so, so not even 20 years ago. And, you know, you came out with a treatment that cost maybe $2,000 an injection into the eye. There are a lot of big question marks there. You know, would people take an injection in the eye? Would insurers pay that much? And the reality is people don't like to lose their sight. And the answers were yes and yes. So that spawned a massive wave of investment. You saw Lucentis, like you said, from Genentech, and, you know, many other blockbusters since then. Another landmark moment in retina was back in around 2017 or 18 when we had our first, you know, gene therapy approved. Spark Therapeutics had approval for one of the IRDs. And that was an exciting milestone as well, because that was a big barrier in terms of, you know, cost of a product. I think at the time it was $800,000, but it was a one-time treatment, obviously, to, you know, tackle a, you know, disorder that caused blindness. And so, you know, once those two things got approved, the wave of investment in retina has been massive. You saw just last year your first two approvals for geographic atrophy. There were no treatments until last year whatsoever. No treatments still to this day for Stargardt disease, or retinitis pigmentosa, many IRDs. So the market is very, very immature. And when the market started back in 2006, you know, I was off developing, you know, oncology compounds. I had just come off of a Hep C program at Roche. I led a brand new Hep C product. And before that, Tamiflu. And then I moved on to oncology and the first immunotherapy, Provenge, worked on that. So I was working in a lot of other therapeutic areas at the time. And when this group came to the table, retina stakeholders back in 2014, and said, you know, we need a retina CRO. I thought, like, what are you, why? And fast forward almost, you know, 8-10 years later, and I get it. And I'm amazed that more people don't get it. This is the most complex area of medicine in terms of the clinical studies. Like I said, I've worked oncology, everything. And, you know, early in my career, and the complexity of these retina studies, certainly a lot of gene therapy, stem cell regenerative medicine stuff, but also just the standard clinical trials in retina, the volume of imaging, the volume of equipment that is unique only to retina. It doesn't even happen in the anterior segment in front of the eye, and the certifications and BCVA and everything is really unique to that space and sets it apart in terms of complexity. So, you know, the space has exploded with studies. I would say the increase in studies in retina in the last 10, 12 years is probably three or fourfold, you know, in terms of annual, you know, study activity and starts and things like that. So it's an exciting space to be in. Anytime you can see advancement in medicine, that's why I do what I do. That's why all the people on our teams do what we do. And I'm sure yourself, you know, in your clinic and your research team, you want to see, you know, medicine advance. You want to see, you know, especially where there's opportunity, where there are unmet needs, and there's a lot of unmet needs still in retina.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, for people, you know, that aren't as familiar with CROs, you know, we work as investigators, we work with a lot of different CROs, and we can, you know, we know who's really kind of focused in on retina and who the CROs that have kind of retina as part of their portfolio, but manage a lot of different other specialties. And it's tricky when it comes to those types of scenarios, because like you said, when you build InFocus kind of from the ground up, thinking about retina from day one, it shows, right? I mean, for us as investigators, there are efficiencies that are created when you do that. You know, and even just the way we communicate with you guys, what you understand are kind of our pain points and help us kind of get past some of these things, getting certifications quickly, things like that, where I think knowing kind of how things work at the ground level is critically important. And I think it's why you guys are able to manage so many trials in such a clean and efficient way. So I think that's kudos to you guys and what you guys have built over, you know, last, you know, many years now. So let me ask you, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, you mentioned a couple of things, gene therapy and some of the things that are being worked on now. You know, you're in the middle of it all, and you're seeing kind of what trials are coming at you. You're seeing, you're engaging with sponsors kind of probably on a daily basis. And you know, not just what we're looking at and investigating today, but what's in the pipeline. So let's talk a little bit now that we've kind of talked about, you know, how InFocus kind of came to be. Now that you're in the space and you're in the middle of it, what are you excited about maybe today? Some of the trials that are going on and that we're looking at? And just as importantly, what are you looking at, you know, a couple of years ahead? Because look, we're looking at new insights, right? What are we trying to kind of get to, and where can patients kind of, you know, be more optimistic in terms of what's coming their way?
Yeah, great question. I mean, the sky's the limit in terms of excitement. I mean, start with GA. So you're talking about geographic atrophy, an area where there was no treatments as of, 12, 18 months ago. Two treatments approved in last year. And those folks to those treatments, Syfovre and Izervay, obviously delay progression of disease. But there's so much more that can be done with GA. And a lot of companies are starting to invest heavily in that. You know, Avecita's got a great product and study progressing very quickly. Hopefully get fully enrolled by the middle of the year and get some strong data. There's others that are coming out with some studies, phase three studies in GA later this year. So the progression in GA, I expect to happen similar to what happened in wet AMD and DME. But those disorders as well, wet AMD and DME, certainly there's room to grow there in terms of getting longer duration of treatments you know, better outcomes and things like that. And then especially I'm excited about things like Stargardt disease, retinitis pigmentosa. So, you know, you're inherited retinal disorders that cause blindness that have no treatments available. You're seeing gene therapies come along, and Nanoscope's a company that's very far along in that process and exciting. We've worked with Endogena Therapeutics, who had a really exciting regenerative medicine technology. But, you know, one hurdle that a lot of these companies face is these are, you know, absolute breakthrough ideas. And investors a lot of times lean towards me-too products. They like safe investments, of course. But, you know, some of these ideas are just, you know, really, really landmark. And so that it is tough to get the right investment behind them. Another example, that is an Annexin therapeutics company out of Sweden that has a really exciting idea in RVO. And it's an infusion therapy, and it's getting really exciting results that we're seeing in clinic. But, you know, people, it's a non-traditional process to, you know, for treatment for RVO. But it takes time to get some traction with some of those ideas. But that's what we're really excited about, is the novel ideas and mechanisms to tackle some of these disorders. Because, again, there's a lot of room to grow. And, yeah, I mean, for ourselves, I mean, as you mentioned, we're, you know, on the ground every day with all of these sponsors. We've got over 20 retina projects now active. And I'm tremendously blessed to be backed by people like Dr. Singerman, Dr. Larry Singerman, you know, is a co-founder as well, and provides us that level of support, as well as all of our scientific advisory board in the retina space, that is so critical to have that knowledge as a backbone working with sites and sponsors. Because it shows when you're working with, you know, the large legacy CRO that are doing one or two retina studies here and there, their teams can't really know the complexities. And to know it, you know, helps you to move more efficiently, more effectively developing these products.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's interesting, you bring up one of these challenges of investment, and, you know, with biotech, obviously, you know, the double-edged sword of retina being so, you know, booming with R&D is that I think investors are becoming more and more kind of critical of their future investments, right? Because it is starting to become a crowded space. I mean, 2006, we had, you know, Lucentis, Avastin, maybe Macugen. And today we have, you know, many treatments, including biosimilars. And so as the space gets more crowded, we have to be more critical of where the investment goes, obviously. So that's an important point. We can probably circle back to that. But along with that, and along similar lines, is as our standard of care improves, recruitment for these trials starts to become trickier, right? So GA is a great example, right? We have GA studies that we are involved in today, but today is different than 2 years ago when we were recruiting for these studies, because there was no standard of care, there were no FDA treatments. And now that we have two treatments, you know, we're starting to see it's a little more difficult to recruit, because patients can say, well, I just want what's FDA approved, and I don't blame them, right? So the question then is, as we move further along and as the space becomes even more crowded, you know, what are, you know, you guys, you know, looking at, you know, obviously for you guys, you got to recruit and you got to help sites recruit for these studies. How are you looking at this problem, and how do you think it's going to evolve over time? And maybe what are some ways that we can kind of bridge that gap or solve this problem?
Well, recruitment for every indication is a massive conundrum. People are trying to address it with databases of patients. But first and foremost, where good quality recruitment on any study starts is you need to have really high quality, committed principal investigators and coordinators. Like your site, I know you've been able to retain some staff, which is really, really important. And also, more importantly, you're committed to research and your team is committed to research. That is by far more important than having a massive database of patients. Because if you have a big database, but you don't have the investigators and the coordinators that are committed to working with patients to enroll in clinical trials, it's not going to happen. So first and foremost for us, we were able to build what we call an RTI, or real-time intelligence database. We track over 500 retina research clinics globally. Obviously, a lot of those are academic outside of the U.S., but in the U.S., a lot of them are private practice groups. We track details on those sites in terms of their study volume, their performance, their budget efficiency, their, enrollment on studies, staffing turnover, all kinds of variables that really affect their ability to enroll well in studies. And that to us is far more powerful than any database that we can come across. That is our database, obviously, but it is a, proprietary method to really identify and select the best sites to run a study right now. Sometimes it's not the sites that did well on, your Pagoda study 5 years ago or your Photon study. A lot of turnover happens in the research space, and you got to stay up to speed with that to select the right sites and get enrollment efficiency. But addressing the fact of, areas that there are a lot of treatments like DME, wet AMD, obviously, or certainly, GA now. You've got two products on the market that are commercially approved. And right now, we have not seen a lot of difficulty in enrolling GA studies. There's a big appetite for the products that are out there in development because they're, leapfrog approaches. They're going well beyond delaying progression, and you're getting some significant, changes that are, much better than the products that are potentially better than products on the market. So patients are excited about that. But there does come a time when it gets very, very hard to enroll studies when you've got a lot of products on the market. And you've got to be more refined with your site selection when it comes down to that.
So let's talk about that for a second. You mentioned metrics on the sites that you work with, and I think that's important. I mean, I think you need report cards essentially for a lot of the sites. But what about those sites that have no track record? So I've been approached recently by, recently graduated fellows or new docs that want to kind of set up their own clinical trial practice, essentially. And they have difficulty oftentimes breaking through, getting that first trial or establishing those relationships when they have no track record. So if you had one or two pieces of kind of quick hit advice, what would you say to those docs that are looking to break through?
I mean, sadly, with anything, the first thing you got to do is invest. You've got to invest in the infrastructure, the, staff that are dedicated to research and, go through GCP training and, investigator training to get an understanding, and also just build your infrastructure in terms of SOPs and make sure you have proper drug storage facilities and elements like that. Of course, equipment, understanding what equipment is required by studies. A lot of times we can't select sites because they don't have the equipment. They don't have the wide field lens or something like that. So ensuring that your infrastructure is good and strong, which it does involve investment, and then making contact with, be it pharma companies, with the people like ourselves that are deeply involved in your therapeutic space. Funny enough, we make it a lot easier because we're in a rare situation where we're certainly the only retina specialty CRO, and we're highly active in the space, and we're always looking for good, young, hungry sites that are passionate about research. Because really, the retina space has been affected in a really negative way by private equity activity that's occurred, because over the last 10, 12 years, I'm sure you've seen it, some private equity groups have been really good about continuing to foster research at sites, but some have not been very supportive of that. And you've got a dynamic where we've seen an increasing number of retina studies, maybe three or fivefold, new studies starting every year over the last 10 years, whereas the number of high quality retina research sites has gone down by almost as much as half. So there is certainly room to add new sites, especially sites that are, excited about research and aren't overwhelmed with studies right now. We're looking for those right now, and we're looking to mature some of those sites and pursuing some initiatives to really help those sites along that pathway. because the
I think that's really good advice. I think, you know, I would definitely encourage young investigators to partner with folks like you and CROs like yourself, because I think it's important. Partnership's important, right? I think, you know, when I first started out in clinical trials, I felt like CROs were somewhat adversarial, right? Like we were constantly butting heads, and I've come to realize over the last decade that really it's a partnership, and it's a three-way partnership between the investigator, the CRO, and the sponsor, right?
It's a very good point you make, and I tell often, you know, sites and especially young people in the industry, you know, monitors and managers and that, especially a clinical site monitor, clinical research associate, is the person that is at your site all the time, you know, working with you and your team. And a lot of them, sadly, get trained by large CROs to be critical, to be confrontational, to, you know, Dr. Seth, you need to store your CV right here in this binder. And you think, why? Why does it have to be there? Why can't it be in my CV binder over here? Well, because they were told by somebody once upon a time, that's not an FDA regulation. That's not a requirement. You have to have it, of course, but it doesn't have to precisely be right here, you know, in this moment. And that creates confrontation. That's at the micro level, but there are many things, as you mentioned, that create confrontation with sites between CROs, but it's supposed to be the opposite. You know, a CRO, a monitor, should be a team with you and your coordinator to create the best data and best execution of a study possible. I mean, nobody's perfect. You know, we're not perfect. We're trying to improve every day. And but the key is to be a collaborative team and to have a good partnership there. So you're absolutely right pointing that out.
Yeah, and I will say as an investigator, when that partnership works well, your site just gets better and better at what it does, right? Your site, your personnel, everybody, it's a constant learning and kind of reiterative process. And so I think that partnership is critical. So that's good. I'm glad we touched on that, because I think that's important for young investigators too. Real quick, so there's, you know, with the FDA recently, I think we've gotten kind of this shift in FDA guidance and kind of, you know, what they're looking for in future clinical trials and endpoints and how we're looking at that. And we've, as investigators, we've been talking about that a lot recently. So I'd love to get your take on it, because you're seeing it from that perspective as well, because I'm sure it impacts, you know, go, no-go decision from the sponsor level. It impacts recruitment, right? Because as these regulations become a little more stringent or the goals of these studies become a little bit more difficult, you know, how are you looking at that? Are you seeing kind of a shift and a change in kind of how we're approaching trials, especially as it comes down from the FDA in terms of guidance? And how are we kind of pivoting to accommodate for those things?
Yeah, I mean, things are moving, you know, at the speed of light, practically, you know, faster than, honestly, than FDA can keep up. And as you know, FDA just had a transition in the space. You know, Dr. Boyd has taken over. You know, Wiley Chambers was there for many, many years and led the organization. So, you know, there's been some change there, which is always exciting. But, you know, I know that they're dealing with these endpoint issues that you're bringing up as well, because you're seeing in a lot of spaces, historically going back, used BCVA as the, you know, basic standard metric for endpoint. But depending on what you're looking at, like let's say you're looking at, you know, these IRD patients, you know, RP patients, you know, Stargardt, that, you know, maybe they're, you know, hand motions or, you know, count fingers and the progression of, you know, three lines or, I mean, there's, a, you know, it's kind of difficult to see that progression, you know, that improvement that you're looking for. But yet, you know, that it's happening when you've got a guy that comes in and gets, you know, a nanoscope gene therapy and he, you know, had to feel inside of his cup of coffee for years to when he's pouring the cream in to know when it's getting to the top, as opposed to now he can see the cream for the first time in his life. But that might not show up on a traditional endpoint measurement. You know something's going on there. You know, that there is light perception happening there that wasn't there before. So it is important to find new metrics, new endpoints. And, you know, I'm confident that the FDA is going to be flexible with that. I'm hearing that they are becoming more flexible in that way and trying to work with sponsors, especially in the GA realm as well. You know, there are, you know, changes, you know, at OCT that you can look at that maybe are more important, far more important potentially than BCVA, you know, or photoreceptor regeneration in certain areas, that if that can be quantified outside of BCBA. So I think it's looking at alternative endpoints, and we need to move as quickly as possible on the FDA side, because these studies aren't stopping and they're progressing. And, you know, once you've started a study with a primary endpoint, it's really difficult, you know, and you've set the statistics based on that, you've powered the study, it's hard to change that.
Yeah, agreed completely. I mean, I think 10 years ago, BCVA was a great kind of, you know, measurement, especially when we're looking in terms of wet AMD and vision gains and things. But it's becoming trickier and trickier. And a lot of the criticism of GA and people still hesitant in treating GA is that we cannot definitively show patients like ease in an easy to understand way why they're better off getting treated versus not getting treated. And so as clinicians, this is still kind of a hurdle for us. And I think the more kind of alternative ways we have of showing people, hey, look, there is an absolute benefit to these treatments, the better off we're going to be. I think you're right. I think you hit it on the head. The problem is these things are evolving so rapidly, but FDA guidance and these approvable endpoints are lagging a bit. And so I think, yeah, if we can get kind of those things caught up, we're going to be able to run trials in a way that we can kind of get these more meaningful endpoints and show those and explain those to not only our peers, but our patients as well, right?
Yeah, I can see, I mean, the example I gave you, when I hear stories like that, when I hear, you know, another patient, you know, Dr. Gonzalez's site was, you know, using a cane for years and comes in for a visit and he doesn't have it anymore. And they ask him what happened. He said, I don't need it anymore. But then maybe that's not quantifying on the scales that the FDA historically has been looking at. But I can tell you, it's kind of like when I go back, you know, 20 years ago and worked on the first immunotherapy in oncology, and the only guys left alive after a few years were guys that got the drug. You know something's working there. So you know this is working, but we need to, work quickly with FDA to figure out how can we show this to you in a way that can expedite, you know, processes, because these patients are, you know, lacking any treatments, and you're seeing that they do have an impact and they are working. So that's what we're excited, but we need to break through. You're exactly right. In terms of, how can we find some meaningful endpoints that aren't just BCVA?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so listen, as we wrap things up, I have one more question. Now, as meeting season kind of approaches and starts to build, and, you know, obviously we're going to have a ton of great data being presented, you know, now I'm asking you this question with you kind of as your CRO leader hat on, you know, because, you know, data presented this year is going to impact trials that happen in the future, right? And kind of where the field moves. So what data are you looking forward to in terms of these upcoming meetings? And it could be anything from stuff that we've talked about, gene therapy, can be TKIs. Where are you looking? Or it could even be different disease states. What are you most excited about? And what do you think is going to help us continue to drive our field forward?
I'm always most excited about areas that are in most dire need. And so it's not to, you know, eliminate things like DME and wet AMD, but there are treatments out there. We feel like it's somewhat manageable in a way. There's been some setbacks in gene therapies, but I really believe in the stem cell regenerative medicine and gene therapies as far as major breakthroughs. And I'd like to see some, you know, some early data on some of those products, the phase 1, phase 2 data. Particularly Stargardt, like I said, IRDs, that's what I'm paying a lot of attention to. And then GA, because GA is getting a ton of attention now because you got the 2 approvals. So those are the areas that I feel are, you know, we need to make, you know, exponential improvements, and there's a lot of room to grow there. So I'm excited. Again, the sky's the limit. Like you said, the meaty season is coming up, starting soon with ARVO and, some of the spring meetings. And that's the data that I'm going to be looking for.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Brett. I mean, I think this has been hopefully enlightening for listeners. I want to thank you for you and your team for all the work you guys do and helping with just moving this science forward as you have been doing so for years. And so thank you. Keep up the great work. And we look forward to kind of having you back on the show, and we can see years down the road if some of our predictions have come true.
I appreciate the time, and thank you as well for all the important work you and your team do on the site side.
Thank you for listening in to the New Insight Podcast. We really appreciate your time. Be sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred listening or watching platform. And if you're interested in more ophthalmology news or other podcasts, visit hcplive.com and check out our offerings. For now, I'm Dr. Viral Sheth. Hope to see you next time to discuss what's new in sight.